This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. During a time when the country was bitterly divided over the issue of slavery, the newspapers of the Civil War era frequently crossed the line that separates politics from journalism. It was a period when partisanship was enthusiastically embraced, and readers often aligned themselves with party newspapers as eagerly as they aligned themselves with political parties. In his new book, Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion, Harold Holzer takes a look at this crucial time in our country's history and how Lincoln handled the dominant medium of his day. Harold, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Abraham Lincoln's comment during the 1858 senatorial debates with Stephen Douglas that public sentiment is everything, to me that sounds a lot like the more recent public relations saying that perception is reality. Was Lincoln ahead of his time and his political peers when it came to his understanding of public opinion and the power of the press to mold opinion?
You know, in many ways, he was ahead of the curve there, and in some ways, he was behind it. So it's an odd mixture. He certainly got it. He certainly knew that there was a communications revolution afoot that was probably just as exciting to people or just as unnerving as Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all the things that political leaders have to deal with today. The news seemed just as instantaneous then, and Lincoln realized that to get elected and to enact statutes, which is the end of that quote, you had to get public opinion behind him, and the only way to do it, or behind one, and the only way to do it was through the press. On the other hand, a lot of his contemporaries simply bought newspapers and expressed their views through newspaper organs, as they were called, that were controlled not just by their own party but by individuals. Lincoln preferred, and I guess he was right, to go around Illinois and visit newspaper editors, hang out in their offices, make friends among editors. And, you know, in Chicago, he tried really hard in Washington, didn't do too well, tried in New York. And that's how he made his alliances. When he finally bought his own newspaper, which was a German language paper, he kept it secret. So must have felt that that wasn't the right thing to do.
Who were some of the early influences on Lincoln developing his sense of the importance of the press and how it molded public opinion?
That's a great question. I haven't been asked that yet. So I would say there were two. One was Simeon Francis, a man who created a newspaper in Springfield, Illinois, which later became Lincoln's hometown. It was such a primitive market, such a small market, that when he reported fires and other happenstances, it was hard for him to describe the locations because the streets didn't have names. That's how primitive things were in Springfield. But Francis taught Lincoln that you know, you could write unsigned editorials and get your political views out there, that you could not only do your election statement, your announcement statement, and he would publish it because he was pro-Whig and Lincoln was a Whig, but that he could also use his printing press to run off handbills and pamphlets. Lincoln learned that the press had many uses if they were allied with you. So he was very influential. And I'll do a second influence that's a little bit off the beaten path, and I would say his wife, Mary. You know, we always say generically, those of us who don't dislike Mary, and there are a lot of historians who do, that she helped him become president. There was something mystical, you know, that she was of a higher economic and social standing, and therefore she made him look good by, you know, moving him along in that realm. Well, there was, you know, she really was a devotee of newspapers, and she helped him, you know, she worked with him to write some of the sort of funnier editorials that they did together. One of them got him into trouble and almost got him into a duel. And then when they broke up, the circle was completed when Simeon Francis offered his house as a place where they could court again. So it was one big happy newspaper family in a way.
Now, you mentioned that Lincoln had actually owned a newspaper at one point during his political career. Why did he do that?
He did it for a very simple reason. It's an issue that we are looking at today again, and that's immigration. Germans were pouring into the West from New York via Germany, obviously, fleeing the failed revolutions of the late 1840s, and they were largely progressives and wanted to be Republicans and needed to register to vote. Sound like a familiar story, I'm sure. Lincoln wanted to make sure that the Germans who were settling in Illinois, especially central Illinois, where he lived, and were getting involved with politics, had a newspaper that would influence them to vote Republican and vote for him. So he bought a German, he invested in and helped create a new German language newspaper in Springfield. And he was never able to read it because even though he took German lessons, he never learned to speak fluently. And he made his own contract, a secret contract with the editor, that if he remained loyal to the Republican Party and the Republican platform at the end of the year 1860, which was the presidential election year, this guy could have the printing presses and everything, and Lincoln wouldn't charge anything. So obviously it was just to influence German voters. They were key in a lot of Western states, and Lincoln was very acute to sense that that would be important again in 1860.
But as you were saying, Lincoln eventually gave up on that idea, didn't he?
Well, he kept the paper through 1860. I don't know if he ever looked at it. But he was assured during the campaign that that it was being pro-Lincoln. You know, all its editorials were pro-Lincoln. After he was elected, he didn't need it anymore. So not only did he let the editor have the presses back, he appointed him American consul to Vienna, where he could use his German as a diplomat. Got him a federal job.
Harold, today's media, whether they really are or not, always talk about how they're unbiased in their coverage of the news, and they cringe at even the suggestion that they're being partisan. How does that compare with journalists and newspapers of Lincoln's time? They almost seem to delight in being openly partisan.
They absolutely did. They were created as partisan ventures. They were either pro-Whig or later Republican or pro-Democratic. They supported those candidates. They eviscerated the opposition. People loved to carry their newspapers in their arms, readers, to demonstrate their political affiliations and loyalties. And the idea of nonpartisanship was looked at as sort of idiotic because there were so many big issues that people wanted to align themselves on one way or the other. And I'll finish the answer with an interesting statistic. So we have press and media that strive to and insist that they're nonpartisan. And the turnout in presidential elections is now about 50%, maybe less. The turnout in the congressional elections is so pathetic, I don't think anybody even can deal with the number. It's something like in the 30s. In 1860, when newspapers were openly partisan, 80% of eligible voters voted in the presidential election. So this kind of open debate, constant ferment, may sound like it was, you know, acrimonious and dangerous, but it did lead to really huge participation, something we're lacking today.
It got people stirred up and got them passionate about voting, didn't it?
Absolutely. It encouraged voting, and it made people understand the responsibility they had in acting on their decisions, not just sitting around and chatting about them.
Did reporters give Lincoln a fair shake when he started his political career?
Well, Republican, you know, Whig and Republican writers did and editors did. Again, the Democratic press in Springfield, and there was, of course, every town had one of each, at least. The Republican papers were very pro-Lincoln, in the Whig papers, that is. And the Democratic papers, to their credit, saw him not just as an ordinary local legislator, but as someone with a major future. And when, as soon as he started making speeches in town and around the state and went to the state legislature to advocate for education and the building of roads and canals and infrastructure, all of this sounds very familiar, doesn't it? It sounds like the State of the Union address.
Yes.
As soon as he did that, he got a belly full of attacks, which I think indicates that they recognized immediately that he was pretty formidable. So a fair shake? No, a partisan shake. More than he deserved, probably, from the Whig papers, and a lot more attacks than he probably should have been pelted with from the Democrats.
There were three major publishers in Lincoln's time, Horace Greeley, Henry Raymond, and James Gordon Bennett. And it sounds like each of them were highly competitive men with big egos. Can you tell us about these three?
Yeah, I centered the book as much around those three as around Lincoln. And I should explain that they're all from New York, where I'm from. But I didn't do it out of New York centrism. I did it because they had national editions that were circulated all over the country, and they were sort of the almost like the wire service for the nation. People copied their stories. And, they were quite a bunch. I mean, James Gordon Bennett came first. He was a disgruntled Democratic editor and later declared that he would be independent, founded the New York Herald. And was not in, he was independent of the parties, but very pro-democratic, very anti-African-American, anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic, goes on and on and on. And really, was the equivalent of a tabloid editor today, sort of a Rupert Murdoch of his day, very flamboyant journalistic style, very negative, very sensationalistic, got into duels on the streets and was beaten up by other editors and then made a big think of it on his own front pages. So he was a character, and he remained very much a major, major force on through the Civil War because he had a lot of money, and he poured it into coverage. Horace Greeley was an anti-slavery, passionate freedom man who founded the New York Tribune and devoted it to the anti-slavery movement and was very, very influential among progressives in the North. He ultimately sort of broke down during the Civil War on several occasions and was a major pain in Lincoln's neck and other regions. Lincoln eventually washed his hands of him after 1864, but very passionate and very important. One of his employees was Henry Raymond, his managing editor, and he paid him so badly that Raymond finally walked out and founded his own paper, and it's the only one of the big three that's still going strong, the New York Times. And the New York Times was very pro-Lincoln, very pro-administration, more moderate than the Tribune, more steady, and so deeply embedded in politics that Mr. Raymond, while he was an editor of the New York Times, was Speaker of the New York State Assembly, Lieutenant Governor, and in 1864, when Lincoln ran for his reelection as president, Henry Raymond, while he was editor of the Times, was chairman of the Republican National Committee, a candidate for Congress from Manhattan, and the author of a major campaign biography of Lincoln, which is sort of the equivalent of being, you know, the David Axelrod who does the media for the candidate. That's quite a handful of responsibilities. And today, of course, it would be complete conflict of interest.
Is it fair to say that Lincoln was a master at manipulating the press?
He certainly became one. And by the time he's president, I mean, in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, he's just starting out to understand. He won't start his debates until the Republican stenographer gets on the scene. "Ain't hit here," he says. Hit is the name of the guy. That was written down by the Democratic stenographer to show what a hick he was, that he would talk that way. But by the time he's president, he's playing one editor against the other. He's doling out exclusives very, very carefully and calculatingly. He's releasing his major annual messages. We call them the State of the Union messages and major speeches very, very selectively. And when he goes to Gettysburg, which is a rarity, for in his day he did not travel much to give speeches, but when he went to Gettysburg, he went on a train loaded with not just dignitaries but reporters, made sure that they were on hand. And when he finished that very brief address, and the AP was providing the copy that would go out to the nation, he took out his manuscript from his pocket and gave it to the AP reporter so he could make sure that he had gotten it right. Lincoln wanted that speech out there among the people, and that plain, beautiful language to be heard beyond the thousands who heard it at Gettysburg. So that's the manipulation. He knows once he's president that every speech he gives, every message he releases is going to its intended, selected, and minimal audience, but that he, as president, can get a wider message out. And he makes sure that the press prints these major letters and messages. And it's the equivalent of today's presidential news conferences or press releases.
Did any of his attempted manipulations ever backfire on him?
Oh, yeah. The 1861 annual message was leaked to the New York Herald, maybe by Lincoln, maybe by his wife. it was investigated by a congressional committee. I mean, you don't go up to Capitol Hill on the day of the State of the Union and read your speech, you know, read the speech before it's read aloud. Of course, today you do, because, you know, they start reading it before the president gets there. But that was definitely not done. And of course, the other thing that backfires, the other sense of, you know, where Lincoln is manipulating is during the Civil War, the government censored many newspapers, imprisoned editors, closed down what they deemed to be disloyal papers in the border states, and even attempted to do so in New York on some occasions, in New Jersey. So it's more than manipulation. It's almost like an iron fist in some cases. And that's been a controversial part of Lincoln's reputation with the press ever since.
You talk about the censorship that occurred during the Civil War. Was that the most widespread censorship we've ever seen in our nation's history?
I think absolutely. I mean, I counted about, you know, close to 200 newspapers that were closed down temporarily or permanently. Editors thrown in jail without trial or charge. Look, in some cases, these newspapers were crossing the line between dissent and treason. And that's the line that Lincoln thought he could determine. And, you know, he kept his own name out of it as much as possible. But in 1864, he signed an order closing down two newspapers in New York City for publishing a bogus presidential proclamation. Not a big sin, except that Lincoln believed that his own draft of a proclamation had been stolen and leaked early. Most of the arrests were people who favored the Confederacy or encouraged people not to enlist or resist the draft, but it's certainly the most widespread, absolutely unprecedented.
There have been several presidents since who were considered masters of the media of their time. Franklin Roosevelt in radio, Ronald Reagan in TV is a couple of examples. Where do you place Lincoln and how he dealt with the medium of his time, the newspapers?
I mean, I think he was every bit as influential. He obviously did not have the radio to give fireside chats. He didn't have movies to establish a reputation as a graceful and assured presence, or, and you left out the one that captivated me when I was a kid, and that's John F. Kennedy, who seemed to be, you know, visually an absolutely, you know, incredible communicator with a great sense of humor. But, you know, by using the telegraph to get his messages around the country, by issuing public letters, as they were called, opinion pieces that he released to the press and that appeared nationwide even as they reached their recipient. I think Lincoln was at the very least, the first president to make use of a modern emerging media. And I know it's hard to understand what made it modern when it seems so archaic, but, you know, before the Lincoln era, newspapers were mostly weeklies. They were printed on hand presses. They were limited in circulation and in copies. So you've got the telegraph that gets news faster to people. You've got steam printing presses that can print tens of thousands of copies of a newspaper every morning and additional editions every day. And you've got eager politicized readers who are zooming circulation. So newspapers go from being weekly to semi-weekly to daily to several editions a day. And it's quite a miracle for people in those days. And, you know, to have kids, it seems, you see it in old movies now when kids, newsboys run around saying extra, extra. They mean there's an extra edition that just hit the streets about something. And that was, the big cities had newsboys hawking extra editions whenever a new battle was being fought, or and other major news, the emancipation, the draft. And I think that seemed to people to be miraculously modern.
Are there lessons that today's politicians can learn from Lincoln about dealing with the press?
Sure. Always stay one step ahead. Be patient and forgiving. Lincoln did not hold grudges. I mean, these are with the newspapers with whom he was in contact. He did not deal with Democratic editors or Southern editors, you know, Confederate editors. But among his crowd, the ones he wanted to keep in tow and maintain support from, you know, his patience, his humor, his quotability and access, he was accessible. When he was having meetings, if there was an important journalist outside, he would allow him to come in. He would meet with them. He wouldn't give out a lot of information, but just the fact that they're in his presence and got to see this kind of, you know, mystical personality, this very sad man who was capable of great laughter. And they came to appreciate him, most of them, and I think they became his first generation of biographers, which is important.
Going back to Greeley, Raymond, and Bennett, the partisan voices of their day, what happened to them after Lincoln was assassinated?
First, they spoke in unison, proclaiming his great loss almost in the same headline words. And then they began, as I say in my book, they resumed their lifelong effort to assassinate each other. Raymond was elected to Congress that year that Lincoln was elected, went on to join the Congress after Lincoln's death, supported Andrew Johnson in the impeachment proceedings because he was, again, a moderate, was sort of ostracized from the progressive wing of the Republican Party, and died young, very tragically, before the end of the decade, had a stroke and died. James Gordon Bennett became even wealthier and wealthier and lost interest. In 1864, Lincoln offered him through intermediaries the idea of becoming ambassador to France if he would only tone it down. And he did tone it down in 1864, and he got the offer and he turned it down, saying he'd rather stay in New York and edit the paper. But he lost interest. He gave it over to his son. Paper was never the same again, and he died in wealthy retirement, one of the most flamboyant and bombastic of New York characters. Horace Greeley was probably the most tragic of those cases. He was very fragile emotionally, maybe mentally. He'd admitted he had a breakdown after the Union lost the Battle of Bull Run. He nearly tried to sell out the Emancipation Proclamation in return for peace by trying to negotiate an armistice on his own in 64, after which Lincoln wrote him off. And yet he sort of refused to be held down. And in 1872, he actually challenged Ulysses S. Grant, who was running then for a second term as president. Greeley took the Democratic nomination. And, I mean, Ulysses Grant was the most popular man in the North, and Greeley was soundly defeated and had another mental breakdown and then died before the electoral votes were counted, and remains today the only presidential candidate who died technically before the official election. Interestingly, the Herald and the Tribune later united and became the Herald Tribune. And even that was not enough to keep it going. It didn't last the 20th century. And the Times was about to fail in the 1890s when the Ox family of Tennessee bought the paper and turned it into the New York Times we know now.
Harold, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure. Happy President's Day.
Same to you, Harold. Harold Holzer is the author of Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion.